I eat, and Grandpa waits by the door, holding my black backpack and his own regular one. He looks at his watch. Abuelita combs my hair. Mali kneels in front of me to button my shirt. She tucks it in, kisses my forehead. Lupe is here, the earliest I've seen her come visit. She hugs me, kisses me, wishes me luck. Julia is sleeping in Abuelita's bed between two pillows to keep her from falling. Abuelita kisses me, kneels to hug me. Then Mali and Abuelita hug me at the same time. Only now, I cry. This is it. The thing I wanted to happen. But it's happening so fast.
Javier Zamora, reading from his new memoir titled Solito. I'm Rachel Martin, and this is Up First Sunday. Today, the story of a 3,000-mile journey from El Salvador to the United States through the eyes of a child. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Smartwool. From hiking summits to running errands, backcountry skiing to couch surfing, Smartwool base layers are everything you need to go anywhere. They make versatile merino wool base layers that offer all-day comfort for all your adventures. They're the first layer you'll want to put on and the last layer you'll want to take off. Enjoy 15% off your first order and find the right base layer for you at smartwool.com.
So I'm just going to start by asking you to introduce yourself, if you could. Who are you?
I'm Javier Zamora, and I'm a writer from a small fishing town in El Salvador called La Herradura. And my book is called Solito, and it's a memoir about my nine-week journey from El Salvador to the United States. I am one of six immigrants from different parts of El Salvador who are trying to make it to the U.S. And we go through boat rides, bus rides. We get taken out of buses by Mexican cops. And we try to cross the Sonoran Desert three times until I finally reach Tucson, where I'm reunited with my parents.
Your father fled to the U.S. when you were just two, and then your mom left to join him when you were five. Why did they leave? What were the circumstances around those choices at those moments?
Well, the war was happening from 1980 to 1992. Both my parents grew up during wartime. They have terrible stories. And my dad left right before I was about to turn two. So I don't remember him. And then in 1995, my mom fled. When my mom left, and I still remember this, she woke me up at dawn and she said that she was going to come back. And I think she meant it. And I think she genuinely meant that she was going to come back. And 3 years after that, she wasn't coming back.
I was struck by something you wrote about the absence of parents at a certain point in your hometown. In first grade, you say you were the only student not to have both parents, but that started changing by the time you were in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. Can you say more about that, what that was like to watch these people just be gone?
The most poignant days of the year were Mother and Father's Days, because all the kids that I grew up with, before first grade, everybody, it seemed like everybody only had one parent, and usually that was the father, who was gone. And in hindsight, that was probably because of the war. As second grade, third grade, fourth grade kicked in, I wasn't the only kid who didn't have both my mom and my dad. And so our grandparents were the ones that kept on showing up to Father's Day and Mother's Day. We were, are a generation raised by our grandparents. And sadly, this wasn't the only town where that was happening in El Salvador. And it's happened all over. And that is part of the problem of the gangs, all these children who didn't have their parents, and all we wanted was to be with our parents.
What memories of your mom were you left with?
In another country like this country, my mom would have been diagnosed with postpartum. Mm. And so some of my initial memories with my mom were not the kindest of memories.
Yeah.
But still, even though I didn't have a rose-colored childhood with my mom, I still missed her hand through my hair, her changing me in the morning, her helping me with homework, which she was always school-focused. So she had this little blackboard that she brought out front where she would make me do homework and then her own type of homework. So I would have the
mom
the best,
homework.
Yeah, mom homework. And because she really wanted me to be the best student. And she would hug me. We would sleep on the same bed. And as a little kid, that's what I missed most for 4 years. Just her literal body next to mine and her warmth at night.
The story, a lot of it is told through the senses. You have a really vibrant way of describing how things tasted, how they smelled, how they looked, how they felt on your skin. Have you always been attuned to those?
I think it's a twofold answer. My grandma is one of the best cooks that I know. Somebody who sells pupusas and it's like a professional cook. I was always her taster.
Mm.
So I think that was training number one. And growing up with all this wildlife in my backyard trained me to be attuned to that. The second part of this answer is trauma. All those details that are in the book are ingrained in my brain. So the details, the smells, the touch, all the five senses, I still carry with me.
So let's talk about the journey itself. What did you think the journey was going to be like? You were 9 years old thinking about this 3,000-mile trip.
I thought that it was going to be almost like a vacation. So I was really excited to go to all these different countries. I thought that I was going to take the fancy route, almost like I was going to take cruises and buses.
The VIP route, yeah.
The VIP treatment. But of course, that wasn't how it occurred.
Were you afraid?
Not the days before I left, and certainly not when my grandpa was with me, because he accompanied me up to the Guatemala-Mexico border. Mm-hmm. And he was with me for the first 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Once he left, and there's this passage in the book where I'm like, oh, I'm alone. Solito, solito de verdad. And I think that's when reality hit, that I was really by myself with all these strangers. And that's when I was afraid.
Your grandfather, he basically begs some other migrants in your little group to look out for you, to be your family, because he's got to go home. You're going to move on alone through this journey.
Immediately, my fear makes me fast forward and skip my entire childhood. I'm this 9-year-old who feels that he must get his act together so these adults don't leave him, because all these family members, all the adults that this kid has had in his life have already left him, and I must behave, make myself small in the room so the adults don't think I'm a pushover. That's what my brain told me to do in order to survive.
Can you describe what happened next? You had to get on a boat.
We were supposed to cross the river that splits Mexico and Guatemala. And that plan changes. instead of a small raft, now this boat gets mentioned. This roofless boat with three motors in the back. And the coyote tells us that we're going to be on one of these boats with 30 other individuals and that we can't cross the river anymore. We have to cross an ocean. Nobody told us that it was going to be close to 24 hours on the boat.
When we come back, Javier talks about a moment of kindness that ultimately changed the outcome of his journey. Stay with us. Welcome back to Up First Sunday. When 9-year-old Javier Zamora left his fishing village in El Salvador, his family expected that the trip would take about 2 weeks. It took 9 weeks, and a lot went wrong. The coyote they'd hired to accompany Javier just takes off and leaves him with a small group of other migrants, all strangers. On a grueling part of the journey, on the open ocean, two of these people offer Javier a small gesture of compassion that changes everything.
In El Salvador, it's even in the winter, it's very warm and humid. So we have no concept of cold. But in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, even during the day, it was very cold. And at night, it was extremely cold. And this mom, Patricia, with her daughter, Carla, we have the thinnest of jackets. And this mom puts her daughter inside of her jacket and then tries to put me in her jacket, and we all, the three of us, don't fit. And it's one of these other people that she knew from her hometown who opens his jacket and asks me if I trust him enough to do the same thing,
right?
Put my arms in his sleeves and so he can zip it up.
That moment, as the reader, you kind of observe that as the birth of this de facto family that you all become.
Yeah.
The people who are responsible for getting you over the border, getting you through the desert, are these coyotes. You end up having more than one. What responsibility, if any, do you think the different coyotes felt for the things that ended up going wrong? Because so many things did.
Don Dago, who's the original coyote who was supposed to be with me, and I was supposed to pass off as his son, I don't know how he lives with himself.
This is the coyote who took your mother.
Yeah. This is that guy. And I don't know how you can know my mom and do that for her, but not for her son.
We should just say, without spoiling details, he abandons you, basically.
Yeah, I never see him again.
Yeah.
Some of them genuinely felt terrible, I think, that things went wrong. Most notably, Coco Liso, who stays in the desert because he's lost. And he pretty much sacrifices himself because he's realized that he's put all of us in danger. And so he just stays.
He's the one who has sprained his ankle too. So
he's sprained
immobile.
His ankle.
Yeah.
He's immobile, he can't walk, and he's just circling the desert. I think he felt responsible for all of our lives. So I think that's the spectrum. And all the other coyotes fall somewhere in between.
What is it like to wait with no information about when you're going to move to the next place, if you're going to move to the next place? I mean, at one point you're locked. You and the rest of your small group are locked inside an apartment for weeks waiting to hear when you can cross the border.
Powerless. You have no agency. And you're also extremely bored. We were all locked inside, not knowing how long we were going to be locked. It ended up being 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks, we ended up hating each other. And in all of it, even though I was a kid who always had to follow the adults' rules, I felt powerless.
Eventually, you do get across the border safely with Chino and Patricia and Carla. But at what point do you realize that you're okay, that you've actually made it?
I think the van. Once we're in the van, every single attempt at the border, at the desert, the coyotes, three different coyotes, always promised vans. Once you make it to the vans, you've made it. Once we did, once I was thrown in the back of this dark van with, I want to say, 17 individuals, and I was a cherry on top. I was this little kid gliding all over these adults, and we all smelled bad. But being on top of that adult pile, I knew that I wasn't going to get deported. I knew that I wasn't going to go back to the detention cell. I knew that I wasn't going to go back to Mexico. And I knew that I wasn't going to go back to El Salvador. I had made it. Hmm. We were on the road. We weren't crossing the roads. We were on one. Hmm. And I could feel the tire below all of us. And even though I remember that coyote cheering because we had made it and we were on a highway en route to Tucson to this apartment. And I knew that in the apartment, I was eventually going to meet my parents. And all of that ended up happening.
What was the goodbye like when you had to say goodbye to Chino and Patricia and Carla? They end up leaving before you.
You know, that scene in the book is the one scene. It always breaks me down. Hmm. You know, they were with me for 9 weeks and then they said goodbye. And then we only stayed in touch for a few weeks, and then I never heard from them again. For 20 years, I didn't want to think about Patricia, Carla, and Chino. In the 3 years that it took me to write the memoir, I thought about them every single day. And once I get to the end, I have to say goodbye again. And it's difficult for me to say goodbye because I genuinely know that without them, I wouldn't be alive. These people that were so real, that have lived and experienced every single thing that I describe, were gone. And as a survivor, which is a term that I didn't used to use for my trip, as a survivor, it is very important to meet other survivors. And what better survivors than Chino, Patricia, and Carla? I survived the boat ride. I survived the desert 3 times. And they are the only ones who can truly say, like, yeah, that happened. And I think that's what I've needed to hear from them for 20 years. And of course, we lost contact, so I couldn't have that. And now I wrote this book. And I hope that they're out there and that they not read the book, but just see that the book is dedicated to them and that I made it, that I'm alive. And I hope that they're alive as well. And so this is my thank you, the biggest thank you note.
Why didn't you want to call yourself a survivor?
It's a very stereotypical thing for survivors not to want to use that term, because once you use that term, you're accepting everything that happens. Huh. And for 20 years, I was running away from it. I didn't want it to be real and I didn't want to face it. And once I changed the narrative and I was like, no, hold up, I did survive this. It gave me more agency. I thought of myself as this helpless immigrant who struggled to make it here. And instead, now I'm a survivor who survived the unimaginable. And I use superhuman strength and luck to make it here. Yeah.
You do work back across the border with other people who are trying to make that same journey. Is that right?
With an organization called Salvavision. Or Salvavision.
Is that something you could only do now that you've reframed your experience for yourself? Otherwise, I imagine it would just Open up all kinds of wounds being in those spaces.
Absolutely. The founder of that organization, Dora Rodriguez, she almost died in the same stretch of desert that I almost died in on my second attempt. And she single-handedly has built a place for immigrants who are deported on the Mexican side, for them to change, to have water, to have food. And she faces her trauma every single day. And when I met her, I hadn't written the chapters in which I'm trying to cross the desert because they were too difficult for me. And seeing her work and every single day was like, what am I doing? Why am I so afraid?
You write in the book that you didn't talk about your experience with your parents beyond that first day when you were reunited with them. How do you think back now, all these years later, to that choice that your parents made?
It's a very difficult choice. You know, I am 32 now. When I was 32, my parents had a 13-year-old kid, which was me, which is absurd. They're teenage parents. And so they were just doing the best that they could. They were children. And I understand it. My life that I have now could not have been possible in El Salvador. I went to Cal. I've gone to Stanford. I've gone to Harvard, which is something. It's an impossibility had I stayed. And in hindsight, they made the right choice.
Javier Zamora is the author of Solido, a memoir of his migration from El Salvador to the United States when he was just 9 years old. Javier, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing your story.
No, thank you.
Today's Up First Sunday was produced by Dan Gurma and edited by Jenny Schmidt. I'm Rachel Martin. We will be back tomorrow with all the news you need to start your week. Until then, have a great rest of your Sunday.